It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Bickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Walker declared a state of emergency due to a propane shortage in Wisconsin. We'll hear how it's affecting people around the state.
The Super Bowl hits the airwaves this Sunday. It's the biggest sports event of the year, but our next guest sees something darker, what she calls the largest human trafficking venue on the planet.
While some people may disagree with her assessment about the scope of the problem, law enforcement and Super Bowl cities has been getting involved the last several years, and McCain is getting out ahead of the issue by pushing for tougher human trafficking laws in the mountain states when Arizona hosts the Super Bowl in 2015.
Cindy McCain joins us now. She's a businesswoman, philanthropist, and wife of Senator John McCain. Cindy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, you've had a ringside seat to the world of politics for years now, but this seems like the first time you've really gotten behind an issue and been vocal. What got you involved? Why this issue?
Well, first of all, let me say I appreciate you covering this issue. What got me started in this, and what was so important is that it was brought to my attention about 2.5-3 years ago now. Just what was going on and how little there was being done about it. And with the McCain Institute, as you know, that my husband and I started, we decided that we were going to make this our humanitarian issue. It has been much, much, much bigger than I ever thought it was going to be, and I'm grateful to say that people are beginning to take notice and step up to the plate on this.
And this is also personal for you, isn't it?
Well, it's personal in that, you know, our state of Arizona has at this point, but will have great legislation earlier, but we had very little legislation regarding this issue at all. Nothing that was specific, nothing that was, that even helped the victims in any way. So we are now, as you know, the governor has proposed a great piece of legislation that also includes a ding at Backpage.com. And with that, we will begin to firm up Arizona with this issue and make sure that we begin to go after the traffickers, and perhaps even down the line make this a flyover state where the traffickers will just ignore us because they know it's too tough here.
Now, human trafficking has been something that we've become more and more aware of over the years, problems in places like Thailand and Cambodia and India, and I know you had an experience there yourself, didn't you?
Well, I did, but let me say also, that is the most common misconception about human trafficking. It is not just an international issue. It is a serious domestic issue that hurts over 100,000 children every year within our own borders. So I did have an experience that brought me to the plate on this whole thing, and it was in Calcutta, India, and I was in a store. I was buying some sari material for my daughter, and I heard some kind of clucking and cluttering underneath the floorboards of this very small shop in Calcutta, and chatted with the guy, the owner, and he said, "Yeah, that's my family," you know, and I didn't think anything of it. It would be very common for a family to leave below or behind or above a shop in that country. And as I was paying up and getting ready to leave, as you walked on the floor a little bit, you could kind of see through the slats and floorboards, and I could see all these little eyes looking up at me. This was not a family. This was a whole lot of kids down there. And the tragedy for me was, tragedy number one is that I saw this and I understood then what was going on, but my shortcoming was I walked out and didn't do anything. And this human trafficking arena that we're in now is not a makeup act. This is just an attempt to make everybody understood what was handed to me in a very strange fashion, and that frightened me. And so I'm glad to be a part of this.
Well, you've called the problem of human trafficking around the Super Bowl the largest human trafficking venue on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
What do we know about the size of it? Do you think you can back up that calling it the largest?
We have a lot of data right now. We need more data. But every piece of data, every organization that has done research around large events like the Super Bowl and others, I mean, it's not just the Super Bowl, it's every major event that occurs, you see a serious uptick in human trafficking and then a downtick perhaps after the events, the major event is over with. Our police in Arizona can back that up. Our police have definitely seen it. They know it exists. They know it's a problem. This will be our third Super Bowl in Arizona when it comes up next year. So people see it and they see the evidence of it and they see the remains and the terrible backlash that it leaves. But we, as you know, there's some research projects being headed up out here at Arizona State University and the McCain Institute that will place in our hands some serious data and hopefully not only back up on what we're talking about, but an ability to be able to trace the traffickers, be able to figure out how to handle this issue on a local basis and train people.
Now, some people have disputed your claim about the size of the problem around the Super Bowl, pointing to the small numbers of arrests made in other Super Bowl cities like New Orleans and Dallas and Indianapolis. What would you say to that?
Listen, human trafficking is not something that you see walking along the street. It's a very underestimated problem because you can't see it. These are girls that are trapped in hotel rooms that are being sold hourly. These are girls that are being moved around the country with great care to make sure that they avoid the police and anyone who might be, our NGOs, you know, that work in this arena as well. It's very, because it involves children most often, it just isn't seen. You know, we've had a number of busts recently in Arizona that have really brought this to light right around human trafficking and children being involved in it. And so it's now coming to light out here, the seriousness of it.
Well, women and children, as you pointed out, are often the primary victims of human trafficking. What do you think needs to be done from a legal standpoint to protect them?
Well, certainly strong legislation. I mean, we are going to, out in Arizona, if our legislation, I have every reason to believe it's going to pass, I've been assured, but I'll obviously believe it when I see it. But we're going to be able to deal with this in a strong fashion, be able to educate, be able to forfeiture the art. We're going to take our traffickers' goods that they have, their money, a number of ways to be able to strongly handle this, and also educate our first responders. All too often our first responders are not really sure that what's going on, and sometimes they see it, but they don't understand it or they miss it. And so we're going to, along with the airlines, I might add, Delta Airlines has been way out front on this, but we're hoping to get our own local airlines involved too.
So with a scope as large as the one you describe, and you've been focusing on the Super Bowl at the moment, the cooperation of the NFL, it seems important. What kind of response have you gotten from them so far?
Well, as you know, Senator Klobuchar and I had a meeting with the NFL about 10 days ago now. And it was a good meeting. We came to it from different angles. We came to it, Senator Klobuchar and I believe, you know, that the NFL should be involved in this issue and should be involved because they want a family, you know, a family event, and so do we. And so I'm happy to say the NFL was responsive. They were listening. One of the issues we wanted to make sure that we brought up to them was the opportunity for the NFL to look at possibly picking a city for a Super Bowl that has strong trafficking laws and that has implements in place that can actually help stop this stuff and save these kids.
So knowing what you do, and you know a lot now, and obviously it's something that means a lot to you, you've experienced it, will you watch the Super Bowl? Will you be able to watch it in the same way, knowing everything you know?
Oh, listen, I love sports just as much as anybody else within the United States. But I also have to look at this, yes, with a little bit of a different eye, because I know that there's a lot to be done. But I want more than, just as much as everybody else, a great event in Arizona and other cities, too, a great event, a fun event, and a safe event. for women, you know, women, children, and everybody else involved. I'm really proud that Arizona has stepped up to the plate on this.
Cindy, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Cindy McCain. She's the wife of Senator John McCain. She's also a businesswoman and philanthropist, and she's advocating for tougher laws surrounding human trafficking at the Super Bowl.
Wisconsin is facing a propane shortage. That's led Governor Scott Walker to declare a state of emergency.
We'll find out how we got here and what's being done to get more propane into Wisconsin.
We have Chris Shan here on the line now. He's Deputy Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Administration. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Rob.
Well, let's start at the beginning. Why are we now in the midst of this propane shortage?
Well, it's a number of different things. And being an economist by training, I really have to look at it from a supply and a demand perspective. On the demand side, it really goes back to last spring. We had a late planting of the grain in the state of Wisconsin, corn primarily. And then we had a very wet fall and a late harvest. So you put all those things together with what was a very bumper crop of corn. We had a lot of corn that had to be dried. And typically that's done by propane, and that uses a tremendous amount of propane. Usually in a normal year, you may be able to get through the grain drying piece and have a little bit of time to kind of restock the tanks and get a little bit of reserve put in place. This year, winter came early and it's come hard, so we never had that opportunity. And then, of course, I think most of your listeners will remember that the polar vortex hit that first week of January. And that was really a body blow to what was left of kind of some of the reserve, the cushion, if you will, that we had. I met with the industry about the 17th of January, and we were looking, well, we might be able to squeeze through if weather cooperates, and clearly it didn't. On the supply side, a number of different things. There was one of the pipelines that flows into Minnesota that serves part of the upper Midwest was down for a couple of weeks starting in late November, and that impacted our ability to get more propane into the upper Midwest. Weather can impact the train traffic as well, so the railroads can't move as much propane during the really cold weather. It limits the number of cars they can put in a train. And we had some derailments that also causes some problems there. What has helped us is the tanker trucks themselves. We were able to extend the hours of service and lift some weight restrictions here in the state, really dating back to October. And they kind of been able to help us keep up as best as we can. But now with this most recent cold snap that's come through, we and the rest of the upper Midwest have really been hit, and supplies of propane are very, very tight. We're using all the infrastructure we have in place with the pipelines, the rail, and the tanker trucks to move propane into the state, but there's only so much infrastructure there, and the demand for it is right now exceeding the supply that we have.
Are there parts of the state that rely more on propane than others?
Well, it's scattered throughout, but the northern part of the state is probably more impacted, but that's not to say there aren't rural areas in most every county, with the exception of maybe a Milwaukee county, where you're going to have people who are using propane, and it can vary so much from one locale to another. Now, over the past weekend, Marinette County seemed to be one of the areas that was struggling the most. I think Columbia County, as we got into today, is beginning to have some of that too. But as the temperature continues to stay cold, we'll see more and more of that across the state.
I want to get a sense of how bad the shortage is as far as affecting the lives of consumers. Is anyone having to go without heat so far, or are they just having to cut back and portion it out? How's that working?
Well, we're seeing a little bit of both. We set up a call center on Friday. We took our low-income call center and then converted that to also take propane calls. And we're hearing, at least anecdotally, of some folks who have been unable to get propane and are going to close down their house and go to a friend's or go to a neighbor's, go to a family member's. And it's sad, but that's the right thing to do. We want to make sure that everybody is safe through this. If you're not able to get propane to get to somewhere that's warm, shut down your house such that you drain the pipes so that you don't have collateral damage of pipes bursting when you do get to come back. But we're trying a number of things in working with the industry as we have through fall, this past fall, to try to find ways to eliminate barriers to getting supply to consumers themselves. And that's certainly one of the things that the governor announced today. Suppliers, as we've seen the spike in the wholesale price, are having trouble, frankly, from a cash flow perspective, being able to procure supply and then and get it to their customers. So what we've done is put together about an $8 million loan guarantee program through the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation and the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority to work with the financial institutions and to have them in turn work with the propane dealers and be able to alleviate some of those problems. So if we've got propane, we don't want to have that be a barrier to getting propane that we do have out to the customers that need it.
You've touched on a couple of the answers to this already, but how will the governor's emergency declaration help people affected by this shortage?
Well, there's a couple of things that we've done, both with that declaration and then some additional actions today. Last Friday, the governor directed that $1.5 million be released in energy assistance crisis money, which gives the counties a lot more flexibility on how they can use that and direct that to those low-income folks, the most vulnerable that could be impacted by the what we're facing today. In addition, today he ordered another $7 million, so we've got $8.5 million in total to be able to address that problem. And so that's part of what we're doing there. With the emergency declaration, what that did is set the entire state government on notice and the potential of activating the National Guard to help mobilize to do whatever we need to do. If that's set up heating shelters, if that's be able to transport people, we just wanted to make sure that we had that step taken care of, so that as this situation, and it's a very fluid situation as it unfolds, we have everybody at the ready to do whatever's necessary to ensure that we protect the safety of the citizens of the state of Wisconsin.
And did I see that the state's existing low-income assistance program had expanded the range at which it will help consumers who use propane, because propane is more expensive, so people who used to be able to afford it can't now?
Yes, and by putting more money into there, we're able to direct that, again, on the crisis side and working with the counties to be able to address those issues in a couple of different ways. Certainly, if we can find fuel and help low-income folks afford that, that's part of it. You can also use that money for relocation if you need to put people into hotels. Buy space heaters if you can find them in the upper Midwest. Those are tough to find. Blankets. So any number of different things to make sure that, again, the most vulnerable here in the state of Wisconsin, we can take whatever steps are necessary to protect them. But we're also going to rely on the people of the state of Wisconsin to look out, look after your neighbors. We're proud people. We have trouble asking for help sometimes. This is one of those times where if you need help, you need to reach out. And all of us who are in good shape now need to reach out to our neighbors to make sure that they're doing okay.
We have a call from Ann in Campbellsport. Ann, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. It seems to me that corn is the culprit here, and so I'm wondering what is going to be done next year to prevent this from happening again?
That's a great question, and we really have kind of focused on the near term and ensuring that everybody's safe. But today, as we met with the industry officials and came out of that, there's really four things that the governor outlined that we need to do. First off, there is a supply and demand element to that, and we've seen a significant spike in wholesale prices. And he's calling on the FTC to take a look at that. Don't know that there's anything that other than supply and demand at hand there, but if there was anti-competitive behavior, we'll want to know about it. I know we heard from the industry there's concern about the potential impact of exports of propane, and to take a closer look at that. Again, not necessarily that there's something wrong there. We just need to better understand how that's impacting the supply here. More regionally, we need to look at the infrastructure itself, be it the pipelines, the rail cars, the tanker trucks, as a region, because we're not the only state that's experiencing this right now. Is there things that we could do to improve the infrastructure so that we have more storage, for example, to be able to manage a really wet fall and immediately cold winter like we've seen this year? It's very unusual. We haven't seen this in the past, but just to be prepared to do that. And lastly, to continue to do what we have been doing since fall is meet directly with the propane industry so that we've taken whatever steps are necessary to try to do everything we can to prevent having the same situation in the future.
Chris, short on time, but light at the end of the tunnel. Are we going to be through this shortage anytime soon?
We need some warm weather. The whole cause of this, to a great extent, was based on weather and the the situation we have now is the same. So if we could get a warmer spell, you might have an opportunity to take the infrastructure, move more propane up here, and be able to put some of that in storage as opposed to using everything that we're getting through there now. So that's what we really need. And we need everybody to work together and make sure that everybody's safe.
Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Chris Shanhair. He's Deputy Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Administration.
And coming up next, we'd love to hear from you. Does the propane shortage in Wisconsin affect you? And if so, how are you coping? And in general, with this cold blast, what are you doing to stay warm and cope with what has been a pretty difficult winter? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. We just talked to a guest from the Wisconsin Department of Administration about the propane shortage in Wisconsin and the state of emergency declared here, and now we want to hear from you.
Whether you want to talk about the propane shortage and how it's affecting you, or more generally, how you deal with the cold weather. Do you remember winters as cold as this back in the old days? How are you dealing with the cold now? Do you have tips on how to keep warm or things to do on a cold day? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to the phones right away and get to Rod, who's joining us from Madison. Hi, Rod.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think about this weather?
Oh, it's cold. I'm a longtime skier and downhill skier and cross country and retired and moved back to Wisconsin because I love winter, but that's not what I love.
not this cold, right?
Not this cold, no. You can't even go out and play in it.
Yeah, so you do love the winter, though. You just think this is pushing. Winter's pushing it a little.
This winter's pushing it a little. But I would like to share, if I could, when I grew up on a little 40-acre milk cows by hand farm in southern Wisconsin. I was about, I think, 5 or 6 when we moved to a new farm, and we didn't have a furnace. That came in later as we got more prosperous. Didn't have indoor plumbing. Didn't have water in the house. We had to go outside and get water off of an old pump with electric motor on it.
Wow.
And that winter, I my father told me, and I remember just bits about it, that it did get down to minus 40.
Must have been a fun night to head out to the outhouse with no indoor plumbing, Rod.
And no indoor plumbing. And no furnace. Our heat was Mom's wood cook stove, because we never had electric stove or a gas stove either. And we pulled down the oven door, opened up an old, not old, but a couch that turns into bed, and Mom and Dad, my sister and I slept with the oven door down with the foot of the bed towards that.
Wow,
On the far wall that morning, it was 15 above in the house.
Oh, no. Rod, thank you so much for sharing your story. I wanted to get some of our other callers, but thanks a lot. And I'm glad you embrace the outdoor weather when you can.
And maybe we could all, from Rod's story, learn to toughen up a little. I mean, some of us have had it worse. Be thankful for what we have. Thank you for sharing those memories, Rod.
I'll go now to Jim in Milwaukee. Jim, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Rob and Veronica. I'm a propane dealer.
Oh.
And one of the things that a lot of people now we're really concerned, of course, what media is talking about is the heating situation. But propane is also causing other problems, the lack of propane. Right now, as a dealer, I'm rationed as to how much propane I can sell. Pricing from last week through today has quintupled in pricing. And the small businesses that I serve, they have forklift tanks that we cannot fill for them, which in turn affects their warehousing operation, which in turn layoffs. So, that is a very difficult thing, not just for the heating part, but also for the economy. And here in the greater Milwaukee area, there are quite a few industries that uses propane for their daily operation.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jim, for sharing that perspective. You're right. That's something we haven't heard much about, how propane is affecting business and industry around the state. Well, how about you? Do you have a story about how you are dealing with cold weather past or present? Call in at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're curious if you can remember winters like this, or is this really sort of the coldest winter almost ever, at least in a very long time? tell us what you remember about the weather and the winters in Wisconsin at 1-800-642-1234. And we'll go now to Ray, who's joining us in Rhinelander. Hi, Ray.
Hi, welcome from 30 below tonight. Can't wait.
Ouch.
Anyway, excuse me. Propane usage has been fairly adequate for years. It's like anything else right now. We have it's all about mathematics, usages, et cetera. People need to look and prepare if they can. Nobody saw this fully coming. I'm not saying that, but there are things that one can do. If you have propane use out in the country, which when I lived out in the country, I always had propane in that. There are a variety of choices. Of course, it depends on the personal economics of someone. There is pellet stoves, outdoor pellet stoves, outdoor wood stoves. You can do a little mini wind generator, which helps with supplying extra electricity for plugging in. And if you're going to use space heaters, you really need to do your research, people. There are some space heaters out there that are not safe. Some of the safer ones are anything that is liquid-filled. Those are radiator-type plug-in ones that have liquid in them. Once the liquid fills, it stays hot, and they're very safe. Also, the quartz heaters. I don't know what else anybody can do. It just depends on your situation. But as far as cold weather, the last snap that we had was in the early 90s, where we had 2 weeks in a row between 25 and 35 below around here in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Prior to that, the 70s had quite a bit off and on, but generally the last 12 years here in northern Wisconsin, we've had so many different variables with the weather, from hot to cold.
All right, Ray, I want to jump in because we've got other callers, but thanks for sharing your temperature there, past and present, and your tips. That's helpful stuff.
And we go next to Norbert, who's joining us in Stevens Point. Hi, Norbert.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think about this weather?
It's cold enough, I guess, but it's not all bad because they say it kills a lot of insects and stuff. But the coldest I've ever seen is 50 below zero when I lived in Athens. When it's that cold, when you exhale, the moisture freezes instantly, and it sounds like little bells as it falls to the ground.
Really? Huh. That sounds like something that kids might enjoy trying out. I don't know if you want your kids out in 50-degree below temperature, but
no,
not so much.
Not good for the lungs.
Well, that's interesting. Right. 50 below you've seen. Well, thank you so much for sharing your memory there and for the breath thing. That's interesting. Thanks a lot.
We've got some more calls coming in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, about how you're dealing with weather. Veronica, you and I just did a thing for the WPR newsletter about what we do in the cold weather. Mine, I'll play board games in any season, but I feel really good about playing them in the winter, especially when it's hyper cold. There's no guilt. No guilt. You're not like, oh, you could be out enjoying this fabulous 70-degree weather.
You should be out jogging or playing tennis.
Right.
No, it's perfectly acceptable to be inside and to be doing what I love to do. Well, we make a lot of pancakes in winter. For some reason, I feel slightly warmer when I'm eating pancakes. I don't know why.
Well, the great thing about making pancakes, I'm usually our pancake chef in the house, and you're standing over the hot skillet. That alone is almost
perfect. Right.
Even if you just throw the pancakes. No, we eat the pancakes.
Being directly in front of a heat source helps a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
All right, let's go to our next caller. We've got Greg on the line from Milwaukee. Hi there, Greg.
Yeah, I was just saying, I moved down from Burnett County because in 2000.
Oh, no.
We lost Greg.
Just when we were getting to the good part. Oh, well.
I believe moved down there after the weather got really cold in Burnett County. He had led him to move to Milwaukee, if I see where he was going there. Well, thanks, Greg. Sorry we lost
He's
you
He's probably
there.
Thinking he didn't go far enough south right
Maybe,
about now.
Definitely. Well, we're going to wrap up with calls now. Thanks to all of you who've joined in. And you can still share your cold survival techniques on the Central Time Facebook page. We are Central Time at WPR, or tweet us. We are Central Time WPR, at Central Time WPR. Superheroes, they're usually the stuff of fantasy, but that fantasy becomes real in the form of real-life superheroes.
These men and women have normal jobs in the daytime, but at night they wear costumes and take part in special missions. In today's Wisconsin Life, writer T. Krulos introduces us to Wisconsin superhero culture.
Real-life superhero is someone that adopts their own costume persona in a superhero motif, and they take on a wide range of different missions. Some of them do charity or humanitarian type things, and some of them actually try to fight crime, which is a little bit hair-raising. The first time I read about them was in 2009, and I was like, if there's a local guy here in Milwaukee, I definitely want to meet him. And I found The Watchman, and I set up this late-night meeting with him in a city park. And then I saw him walking through the park in his superhero gear, and I was amazed. I was like, wow, this guy is actually real. He wears a red rubber cowl. He has some red leather gloves. He has a shirt, and he has different shirts depending on the weather. It's kind of a unique Wisconsin concern for superheroes. So he's wearing a thick sweatshirt with his Watchman logo on the chest, and a trench coat and army boots and army pants. And that's his signature Watchman look. Some of them are pretty open about who they are, and some of them are very protective of their identity. And they have a variety of reasons for that. Some of them say they don't want criminals to know their secret identity. And some of them, I think, just are concerned they don't want their coworkers to know that they have this unusual hobby. So real-life superheroes have this term called coming out of the phone booth. And that's when they reveal to other people that they're a real-life superhero, to mixed results. Sometimes it goes well and sometimes it really doesn't. The Watchman's approach compared to other real-life superheroes I've met is pretty mellow and sensible. He does a patrol, but it's more like a costume neighborhood watch type thing, where he's looking to observe and report more than he's trying to swing in and try to beat up bad guys. He also does a lot of things, like he does an annual Christmas charity where he uses his flashy appearance to kind of draw attention to a toy drive. As time went on, I ended up joining him on patrol several times, and a cool thing was I got to see him inspire other people to join him, and soon he wasn't the only guy here in Milwaukee and was rolling with a team of four or five other guys. The name of the local team is the Challengers. And it also includes Blackbird, Crimson Crusader, Charade, Night Vision, and then Electron actually lives in La Crosse. They go out by themselves or with whoever's available, and sometimes when they can coordinate their schedules, which I found is actually just as difficult for real-life superheroes as it is for normal people, when they can coordinate it, they roll as a team, and it's quite a sight, actually, to see all of them walking down the street together.
T. Krulos is the author of Heroes in the Night, Inside the Real-Life Superhero Movement.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode is produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find more info at wisconsinlife.org.
Now T. is with us to talk more about real-life superhero culture. T., welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, since first hearing about this real-life superhero culture, you've gone on, you've written a book about them, you've met them. Are they still as fascinating as when you first started out?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I still hear from some of them, and I'm always glad to hear from them and hear what they're up to.
What is it that fascinates you so much about real-life superheroes and has inspired you to meet so many of them?
Well, they're a unique breed of people, that's for sure, and it's a bold choice. And I've always been a superhero comic book fan myself, so I think that was part of the initial fascination for me, was meeting superheroes.
Well, I think everybody wants to meet a superhero. You have this idea of somebody with superpowers from the screen or from comic books. I don't know. What is it like when you meet them and you've got that perception in your mind? How does it square?
Well, they're definitely not like the comic books. They really get tied down with a lot of worldly things. Like, I remember one time I was with the watchman who was talking about in that piece, and we couldn't find his car in a parking garage.
Oh, no.
Which was something that happens to all of us, but it was just kind of funny because he was dressed as a superhero.
Well, one of the most important parts of any fictional superhero story is the origin story. What are the origins of a lot of the superheroes you've met? Are there common themes that inspired them to make up a costume and get out and do what they do?
Well, I think it's varied quite a bit from person to person. Some of them do have a specific reason that kind of inspired them, whether that's having some sort of bad thing happen to them, or some of them, I think, are just bored, and it was an appealing idea. But I think a lot of them, in general, are just kind of sick of turning on the news and you know, seeing all these bad things happening and not having the power to do anything. So it's kind of a self-empowerment thing at times.
How does law enforcement generally look at superheroes who are out there? Not all of them are trying to sort of fight crime or be a presence that way, but does the law enforcement agency, you know, enjoy their participation?
That's varied a little bit too. Sometimes they just kind of get a friendly wave, or even I've seen police officers pose for pictures with these guys, and sometimes they're kind of confronted and told, look, we appreciate the help, but we'd rather you leave the crime fighting to us because we're the trained professionals.
What kind of day jobs do real-life superheroes have? The Watchman, for example.
You know, I found out a lot of things about The Watchman, but he never told me what his day job was.
I think that's classified, Rob.
But some of them did share, and I found a really wide range, actually. I mentioned in the book, you know, there's a guy who does it who's a dishwasher, and then there's another guy who had a pretty prominent office job at a Fortune 500 company. So there's a wide variety of people drawn to it, and the one thing that draws them to it is sort of the mythology of this superhero.
Do you think that the people that they come across generally are cheered up by them or inspired by them, or is it just kind of a weird thing? I don't know. How do people react when they meet them?
They react in a lot of different ways. Some people just don't really get it, and they don't understand it, and they think it's weird. And some people kind of go right on, you know, and are really excited about the idea. So I guess it depends on your personal taste and opinion on it.
Is there a favorite comic book superhero for real life superheroes?
I took kind of a poll. They have a forum, or they used to have a forum where they exchange ideas online. And I took kind of a poll, and number one character mentioned was Batman, for sure.
Well, that kind of makes sense because he doesn't have any built-in superpowers except for wealth, but otherwise it's all training and gear.
Right.
I don't think wealth counts as a superpower. Huh? Well, maybe
Bruce Wayne
that.
Makes it work.
I want to ask about what it's like being with these guys. Well, you said that, and there are women who do this too. I want to point that out. But you've been on patrol with the Watchmen. You said that one's a little more laid back than some of the other patrols. What's the coolest thing that you've seen a real life superhero do?
I think, you know, one of the coolest moments for me was just seeing them be able to help out people. And the way they're most effective of doing that is they do things like hand out supplies to homeless people. And, you know, I think it was inspirational to me. You know, people say, well, they don't need a costume to do that, which is true. It's a little bit surreal, but if that's what works for them, you know, more power to them. So I thought it was inspirational to see them devote their time to helping other people out.
Is this an American thing, or have you heard of other countries getting in on the action?
Other countries have. And those can be some of my favorites because some of the foreign translations are pretty quirky. So, but yeah, the most of them are Americans, but there's small pockets of them that appear in Italy or Great Britain or Australia and random places.
Well, do you have any examples of good quirky superhero weird translations?
I really liked, there's this Italian superhero named Entomo, and he was a insect themed, and he was very enthusiastic about what he did. But, you know, and he, of course, his English is better than my Italian, but, you know, some of his sayings would just kind of come across as being hard to understand.
One of the ones that caught my attention on, there's a picture of several of them, but there's a guy named Thanatos.
Yeah.
It's like he's from Vancouver. Tell us about him.
Thanatos, as I was kind of mentioning a moment ago, he was really kind of an inspiring story to me. He's a 62-year-old Vietnam vet, and he was handing out supplies to homeless people before he was a real-life superhero. And a police officer saw him doing that one day and told him that he was wasting his time because these people had nothing to look forward to except for dying. And when he heard about real-life superheroes, he was a comic book fan and kind of adopted this persona of the Grim Reaper and tried to make death sort of a friendly figure. And you know, he spends a lot of his own money and time gathering supplies and hanging out with homeless people and trying to help them out. And he does it wearing this kind of creepy costume. But the surprising thing to me was I was really kind of skeptical of it, but when I went up there and met him and walked around the streets, I realized that all of these homeless people knew who he was, and he had become kind of a street legend in Vancouver. And it was kind of a cool thing to see.
T, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That was T. Krulos, author of Heroes in the Night, Inside the Real Life Superhero Movement.